Hello and welcome to NewsHour, live on the BBC World Service, coming to you from London. I'm Krupa Bhatti and it's very good to have you with us. We begin in Germany, where talks are continuing at the annual Munich Security Conference. This is where world leaders gather to debate the most pressing challenges to international security. And much focus has been on how to end the war in Ukraine. The meeting happens in the shadow of that phone call just a few days ago between President Trump and the Russian President Vladimir Putin, in which the leaders agreed to begin negotiations to end the war. Mr. Trump had said the US, Russian and Ukrainian officials would meet in Munich, but that has not happened. There have instead been lots of questions about where Ukraine fits into these conversations. President Zelensky took to the podium this morning and said that Europe should step up and create its own military.
Let's be honest, now we can't rule out the possibility that America might say no to Europe on issues that threaten it. Many leaders have talked about Europe that needs its own military, an army of Europe. And I really believe that time has come. The armed forces of Europe must be created.
The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, has told the BBC the bloc didn't need a separate army as an alternative to NATO.
We have armed forces in Europe. We have 27 different armies, and these armies are interoperable and are working together. Some of them in NATO, 23 of them in NATO, but also four in addition. So we don't need a European army. We need the 27 armies to work together perfectly.
I've also been getting the view from Latvia, a country that shares a border with Russia. Latvian Defence Minister Andris Spruds gave me his take on developments, starting with whether there needed to be a joint European defence force.
NATO is, of course, crucial. At the same time, we have to strengthen the EU or European pillar of the transatlantic alliance. So certainly here is still room for strengthening European national forces with financial contributions and donations. Then, of course, coordination is important. This is certainly where the European Union or European countries more widely can contribute to the unity and strength of transatlantic defence alliance.
Well, let's expand on what you raised there, this room for improvement, especially when it comes to the financial aspect, because Latvia, its Baltic neighbours and Poland, you've all raised your defence spending much, much more than some other EU countries, especially those at the other end of the continent. What would your message to those countries be?
My message would be that let's be clear on what we are facing. We are facing the existential threat. So there should not be differences among the countries in terms of the perceiving the threat somehow differently. So as you mentioned, Latvia contributes, invests more than 3%, this year 3.5%, next year we'll already be approaching 4%. And this is what must be done. Russia is not changing its expansionist, revisionist dictatorship, and we have to be ready for all kinds of scenarios.
You mentioned straight off there in your first answer that NATO is crucial. As a close neighbour of Russia, you share a border with Russia. Does it make you increasingly nervous that we now have the US saying that this war is a European problem that needs a European solution?
With regard to Ukraine, yes, of course, at the moment we have, in a sense, debate, dialogue on how to proceed. We stated clearly that any peace agreement can be direct participation acceptance of Ukraine, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, but also European partners should be part of the negotiations, because exactly European partners are taking this responsibility to contribute more and have it in a unified approach.
Staying with the US, we had that phone call between President Trump and President Putin. The idea that direct negotiations may well take place, does that feel like appeasement to you?
There are principles which for us are extremely important. We have to negotiate and act from positions of strength with aggressor country. That if we discuss specifically Ukraine and Russia's aggression in Ukraine, then the principle of the territorial integrity is extremely important. And let's not make any concessions before actual negotiations start. But as I said, so that there is a transatlantic debate and frank exchange of thoughts. We, of course, all want to have peace. And I think not least Ukrainian people deserve and want to have peace. But at the same time, the peace must be just and lasting and sustainable. Also, in a process of having the dialogue with our transatlantic partner, the United States.
And that was the Latvian Defence Minister, Andris Sprut, there. Let's bring in the BBC's Chief International Correspondent, Lise Doucette, now. Lise, we were just hearing there from Andris Sprut talking about there being room for growth when it comes to defence spending, the various defence spending of European nations, but also that the threat of Russia should not be perceived differently by different European countries. What do you make of that?
Oh, these are defining moments here in Munich. So many are saying that they've never seen a Munich Security Conference as dark and as gloomy as this. And I think it's hard to say, aside from Viktor Orban of Hungary and some right-wing parties across Europe, that most of Europe, at least when it comes to Ukraine, they see it as a threat, an aggressor, as someone who has violated brutally what they call here in Munich, it's the foundation of the Munich Security Conference, a rules-based international order, the best way to achieve some kind of stability. And of course, that's also founded on Europe and the United States and Canada working together. But this is one of those moments where the Europeans are realizing that it's a different game now that President Trump is back in the White House and set on setting the rules of his own game. And that creates a huge problem for Ukraine, which, of course, is worried now about Ukraine's future and whether or not peace is actually some kind of peace will ever be on the horizon. Earlier today, I spoke to the former Ukrainian Prime Minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and I asked him, as he listened to all of the conversations, how he would describe the mood in Munich.
The Europeans are completely shocked with the latest developments relatively to European-American relationship. I wasn't, frankly speaking. So we have to use to this. And the thing is that we need to circle the wagons. In order to defend the values, in order to defend Europe, and in order to defend Ukraine. Whether there is a chance that Americans can leave this kind of righteous fight, there is a chance. And we have to realize that we need to do our utmost to bring them back. Because it seems to me that Putin right now is popping champagne or vodka, because champagne would be the next step, because he wants to lift sanctions. And that's the reason why he is urging President Trump to get these kind of bilateral talks as quick as possible.
So you think that phone call between President Trump and President Putin gave away too much to the Russian leader?
Not yet. But the optics is bad. And all this verbal diplomacy smells not really good.
One of the main concerns expressed by President Zelensky, and he says he speaks for all Ukrainians, is that what matters a lot is security guarantees. What are your worries about security guarantees? The U.S. is indicating it will only be Europe that will be responsible for that.
I strongly believe that the only security guarantee which is viable and solid one is the Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, period.
But the U.S. is not agreeing to that.
And that's an issue. But let me remind to the United States government and to all NATO allies that first, the U.S. signed a notorious Budapest Memorandum, and the United States was a guarantor of Ukraine's territorial integrity and independence. That's not legally binding, but that's politically binding. The second one, in 2008, in Bucharest, the NATO allies issued a joint plea, and they've been committed to make Ukraine a NATO member state. So I do believe it is not within the U.S. powers to reject Ukraine's NATO aspirations. And I do believe that the new U.S. administration is to realize that Russia is an arch enemy and arch rival to the United States and to the security of the American people. And the stronger NATO would be, the stronger U.S. would be.
Are you hearing from American and European leaders here what you as a Ukrainian wants to hear about solidifying your future?
On the one hand, I am inspired with the language of our European friends. They do understand the threats, they see the challenges, and they want to find the way how to fix all these challenges. On the other hand, we have to undertake an enormous efforts in order to persuade the American administration to lead this crazy world.
And if they don't?
If Americans fail to be the leader of the free world, I know who's going to win. Trump has to realize that Putin is to win, and Putin wants to humiliate the United States.
And that was Arseniy Yatsenyuk speaking about his real fears, because it's existential for Ukraine. It's no exaggeration to say that when they're facing an enemy like Putin, who made it clear that he doesn't believe that Ukraine is actually a country. It's a fictitious country in his mind. It should be a part of Russia. And that's why so much is at stake here, as Ukraine, and indeed Europeans, because it's not just Ukraine. Europeans say there's got to be a stronger security architecture. And it's really noticeable here this year how Europeans are emphasizing that they understand they have to do more, to spend more on their own defense. But they also say they want to do it in partnership with the United States.
Ukraine aside, Lise, there have been other conflicts on the agenda as well, including Syria, or post-conflicts rather, in Syria's case.
Krupa, I was actually moderation at Munich, and I started by saying that everyone...
I'm afraid we are having problems with Lise's line, but we, of course, have been hearing a significant amount from her about that situation, those conversations taking place inside those various rooms in Munich, that international security conference taking place. If you have missed any of what we have talked about, you can always pop along to where you get your BBC podcast. The podcast of the programme is available there, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine, BBC NewsHour podcast, and you'll find it there. And if you are really keen, you can subscribe to the feed and you'll find us there on a regular basis. Coming up, we will revisit the AI Action Summit, which took place in Paris this week, and we'll hear from one illustrator who's concerned that the technology could replace her.
Artificial intelligence, after using a lot of human art to train on, can then create an output which would be a piece of art for the user. This could completely omit the need for a human artist or illustrator.
And the headlines from our newsroom. A US envoy has indicated that Europe would not be directly involved in peace talks for Ukraine, despite being expected to play the main role in providing security guarantees for any deal. And a crush at Delhi's main railway station has left at least 15 people dead as pilgrims travel to and from the Kumbh Mela religious festival. It's being called an American cultural institution. This weekend, Saturday Night Live is marking its 50th anniversary. The weekly TV show has helped generations of well-known comedians with their big breaks, from Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd to Mike Myers and Tina Fey. But it's not only comedy that the show is famous for. Ahead of Sunday's live 3-hour special, the weekend celebrations began last night with a concert featuring musical acts that have featured throughout the years. Well, I've been speaking to Kate Pearson, singer and keyboard player with the B-52s, as she recovered from last night's anniversary concert in New York.
It was amazing. It was so thrilling. It was such a blast to get up. We just did one song, and we thought we were going to do Rock Lobster initially, because that's the first song we did. You know, that's the song we did on the first Saturday Night Live appearance. It was in 19... What was our first appearance?
It was 1980, wasn't it?
Thank you!
Yes.
Thank you for being my hard drive memory. Rock Lobster was sort of the iconic SNL song that Dave Grohl saw and said, like, it was just so weird. They were so weird. And it just changed my life. And I've heard that so many times, that people said, we were so weird. And I was talking to Fred Schneider in our band, and it was like, you know, were we really that weird? We don't feel weird, but apparently it was weird enough to make people sort of jolt and think about music in some different way. And all the SNL performances, the ones last night, even though we did Love Shack, which was another iconic song of ours, which gave people a lot of joy, I think, all the performances were so amazing last night. And luckily, we were maybe an hour into the show, so I got to go sit with my wife, Monica, and enjoy the rest of the show.
When we talk about Saturday Night Live, we think of it as primarily a comedy show with sketches, with monologues. But what did it mean for music?
To me, I grew up watching, when I was a kid, a little kid, the Ed Sullivan Show. And I remember seeing Elvis Presley. And my mother and I and my dad were watching. And Elvis Presley came on. And it was like, whoa, this is so different. And they blacked out his pelvic area because he was moving in a, you know, in a sensuous way. And it was just like mind-blowing kind of thing. And SNL had that effect, I think, of showcasing all these iconic musicians. It was not only hilariously funny and had iconic comedy sketches, but also showcased, that was a big treat of the show, was the musical guest. And some of it was just so groundbreaking, especially Sinead O'Connor. To me, that was one of the most groundbreaking appearances, where she ripped up the picture of the Pope and sang War. It was just a moment, a cultural moment, I think, when somebody made this statement. Nobody in America really understood, I think, what she was doing until later. And everyone was like, really, wow, they're angry. But it was just one of those moments when someone really spoke out.
It almost sounds like these were opportunities to change the conversation, to go rogue a bit.
Yes. I mean, Elvis Costello changed up his song and did Radio Radio, which he was banned from the show for 10 years after doing that. It was just, you know, Billie Eilish, it showcased all these new artists. Radiohead was on, you know, just everyone. The list goes on. Prince, David Bowie. It just, the list continues, you know, Nirvana. So many female artists, too. So many women showcased, which was great, even though rock and roll was such a boys' club.
Here we are marking 50 years of SNL, and it's really put its stamp on American culture. What do you think, Kate, has kept it relevant all these years on?
Well, definitely the political humor. I mean, the continuance of showcasing new musicians, that was always like the amazing kind of treat you would get to see these music performances. But the political commentary, the, of course, imitations, iconic imitations of, I wouldn't even say his name, whoever, the person that's the president, unfortunately, of the United States right now, is, you know, those performances were really, gave you this relief, this sense of relief. There was such a tension, maybe political tension or whatever was going on. They would bring this attention to it, but a release of laughter. And that was just like, just so, such a gift to have, to watch that show and just laugh.
We do have to mention that you have your own 50th anniversary coming up soon, next autumn, I believe.
Well, this is this year, and this yesterday, Valentine's Day, was our 48th anniversary, because 1977 was the B-52's very first show. It was a house party in Athens, Georgia, Valentine's Day. And talk about weird. We did look weird at that show. We had Cindy and I had these, they were fake fur pocketbooks turned upside down into white afros. We wore black and white, and it was just at a friend's house, and it just rocked. We rocked the house. Our friends danced until the speakers fell off the walls, and it was just, that was the day we started.
How are you going to mark it?
Well, we marked it last night.
That's a start.
But the 50th one, I don't know. We have to do something really special. We have been doing Vegas residencies. We have possibly pretty definite, we're going to do some shows with Devo coming up. It's not set yet. I don't want to let the jack out of the box, but we shared a dressing room with Devo last night, and they're just another iconic band that is just so groundbreaking. And David Byrne and Devo, and we were all on last night, and it was kind of from the same era when we came up in New York City and going to, you know, playing at the Mud Club and CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. So it was kind of an all home week too, to see all these other performers. But I don't know how we're going to mark the 50th. We're going to have a big, big something.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Incident is one of the five films nominated at next month's Oscars as Best Documentary Short. It's a second-by-second account of how an African-American barber in Chicago was shot dead on the street by a police officer. Much of the material is taken from police body-worn cameras. Vincent Dowd spoke to the film's makers.
Police shot. Shots fired at the police. Police officer The new documentary, Incident, lasts only half an hour. It's shocking in its depiction of the shooting dead of Harith, or Snoop, Augustus in the summer of 2018 on Chicago's South Side.
We need some more units over here.
We're getting some more units coming that way.
Director Bill Morrison.
Police stopped a 37-year-old barber on the south side of Chicago in 2018 because he appears to be carrying a gun. In Illinois, you can carry a gun. There's concealed carry laws. So they stopped him without probable cause, and he evaded their grasp, went out into the street, and where he was shot by one of the officers.
There were extra police officers on duty because of previous incidents. Among them was probationary officer Dylan Halley. We first see Snoop Augustus, who held a gun permit, on CCTV. Then an officer notices the gun. The film's co-producer, Jamie Calvin.
When he lay on the ground, dead or dying, an officer had to unfasten his gun to take it out of his holster, contrary to the police account that he had pointed a gun at them.
Snoop Augustus died after being shot 5 times by Dylan Halley. He did not take his gun from its holster, though the official report later said Augustus had reached for the weapon. Protest built on the street as the community, almost entirely African American, realized what had happened.
There's this notion that the critical question is whether police were justified in a split second of danger to use lethal force.
Jamie Calvin again.
The police, through their conduct, produce the split second in which they choose to use lethal force.
A false narrative emerges in the minds of the police that a gun had been pointed at an officer.
The fire, 31.
Pull the gun out.
He grabbed him and he cut
it. Doesn't matter.
You're okay. Yeah.
Pull the gun out.
I know he did.
You all didn't do anything wrong. I want you all to know that.
Officers are saying things to one another to try to find language to justify what they've just done.
They had all been coached on, now you were going to be wearing a camera. Not only are you wearing a camera, but your alibi is going to be scrutinized by what you say on this camera. So I very much think that they've been coached on how to perform with the camera on them, and they were acutely aware of it.
The Cook County State Attorney's Office decided there was no evidence to justify criminal charges. The entire Oscar-nominated documentary Incident is currently available to watch free online.
Vincent Dowd reporting for us there. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Krupa Bhatti. Earlier today, Hamas released 3 more Israeli hostages as part of the first stage of the Gaza ceasefire plan. They are the dual nationals Alexander Truvanov, Yair Horn and Segi Degelchen. In exchange, 369 Palestinian prisoners were also released by Israel. This, of course, comes after Hamas said on Monday it would pause the release of any hostages this weekend, blaming Israel for alleged violations of the ceasefire, an allegation denied by Israel. After a week that has left the ceasefire delicately hanging, there is much concern about what might happen next as both sides look towards that crucial second phase. To discuss the day's developments, I've been speaking to Tal Schneider, a political correspondent at the Times of Israel.
There was a huge relief to see those 3 men getting out on their feet. It was good to see them, and it's good that the agreement is back on track. The problem, of course, is that the president said that he wants to see all of them out by today at 12, which is something that was not probably possible from the Israeli side because you don't want to breach disagreement. I mean, as long as you have 3 people out every Saturday, you don't want to ruin that and have them stay in and get killed. So on one side, people want to see the entire group out immediately, but then they also want to fulfill this agreement in order to keep it going.
On that, looking ahead in terms of keeping it going, we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu is holding security consultations tonight on the future of the deal. What more can you tell us?
They want to go by Trump's design and get, you know, everybody out immediately. But, you know, the big question is, how do you get there? And you have 6 more people who need to get out in the next 2 weeks, and then 8 people who were murdered inside the captivity. and you don't want to ruin the chances for them to be out.
You talk about the speed at which they want to get all of the hostages out. We know that Israel's Channel 12 are reporting that Netanyahu wants to expedite the release of 6 more living hostages. These individuals are currently scheduled for release on the coming 2 Saturdays, and therefore he wants to extend the current first phase of the deal. Do you have any further details on that?
It's a difficult situation because it means opening the deal and renegotiating. And they're already supposed to be out, as you said, 6 people in the next 2 weeks. But then you have more 22 people who are still alive on top of the 6. And how do you get everybody out immediately? And you need to negotiate that. That's the problem.
And of course, negotiations would therefore run into a potential second phase. I mean, how much appetite is there from the government, at least, for this ceasefire to even enter a second phase? And what do you understand about where those talks have reached?
All public polling suggests like 80% of the people really support this deal and the negotiation on the second phase. The government is, you know, some of them are still talking about resuming the war, and they think that resuming the war will put more pressure on the Hamas to get the next 22 people out. And that's a very difficult, you know, equation, because it did not prove itself to be true in the last year and 4 months.
It is a concerning time for so many of the families who are awaiting news of their loved ones. You talked about that midday deadline and the Trump design to bring the hostages home. In reaction to that, President Trump has said that it really is up to Israel when it comes to the next move, that the United States will back the decision they make. What is the feeling about where the power lies in this relationship at the moment?
I think the prime minister and the ministers, they really want to make sure that Trump is satisfied by them, if you can call it like that. And so for that reason, they keep saying we want to go along with Trump for what he said. But yet again, it's not like the terrorists are just, you know, doing whatever they've been told to do by the president. It doesn't work like that. So it's a tricky situation.
Of course, today also saw the release of more Palestinian prisoners, and many of the 36 prisoners who have been serving life sentences are being deported to Egypt. What do you know about that decision?
So as far as we know, they are only there on a temporary situation. Egypt doesn't want to have them at all. This is convicted murderer, terrorist who killed people, and they're supposed to get out of Egypt and move somewhere else. The problem is where to. They're supposed to be moving away from Egypt to, I don't know, maybe Turkey, maybe Qatar, maybe Algeria or Tunisia. We don't know the details of that.
Tal Schneider, a political correspondent at the Times of Israel. To the conflict in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where M23 rebels have entered Bukavu, the eastern region's second largest city. This comes as heads of states from across Africa met at an African Union summit in Ethiopia. The mineral-rich east of the country has been dogged by conflict since the 1994 Rwandan genocide. The M23 is backed by Rwanda and led by ethnic Tutsis, who say they needed to take up arms to protect their rights. For more, I've been speaking to the BBC's Richard Kagoi in Nairobi.
The situation is very volatile at the moment as you speak. What has happened is that the M23 have managed to capture a strategic airport, which is about 30 kilometers north of Bukavu. They have been advancing towards the city. It's difficult to ascertain if they have taken control of the city because of the struggle to get information out of Bukavu itself. As we've been speaking to sources who are currently in the city, is that the situation is very tense. Sporadic gunfire.
There have been reports Congolese forces have provided little resistance to this advance.
Absolutely. Those are the reports we have, that the Congolese forces, who are backed by Burundian troops and allied militia, abandoned their positions, especially at that airport. The challenge is that the troops are demoralized. They're not so resourced in terms of equipment.
Explain to us, Richard, why Bukavu matters to M23.
it's part of the ambitions to lay claim to the territory. What they want to do is expand their influence, and with this, then their benefits that they accrue from that politically. And also, this is a region that is so wealthy in terms of natural resources. This is a group that has actually even threatened to march towards the capital city. And this is quite reminiscent of the situation we had in 1997 when we had rebel groups that were backed by neighboring countries, and they marched and they brought a change in government, deposing the long-serving Mobutu Sese Seko the late. So there's a lot of concern that if you have Burundian troops who are fighting alongside the Congolese forces inside DRC, and Burundi and Rwanda don't see each other eye to eye. In fact, the president of Burundi has accused Rwanda of harboring expansionist agenda. Then you see how this now sucks the entire region. And that's why the UN chief was really cautioning that there's a possibility of this war really taking a regional dimension.
And related to that, we've had this meeting today in Ethiopia where African leaders have been talking about ways to end the conflict there. What have we heard from that?
Majorly, we had from the outgoing chairman of the Africa Union really calling for a cessation of hostilities, saying we need an immediate ceasefire. But I think the most important thing is now just following up on the commitments that were made last weekend at a joint summit between the East Africa Community and the Southern Africa Development Community, where they agreed to combine two regional initiatives that were, you know, led by Kenya and also Angola. So it's not just about talking, but now I think the action, if you had to Antonio Guterres saying now, it's time to implement the dialogue. It's time to have the conversation between the groups of the warring parties that are involved in this conflict.
What do we understand about the humanitarian situation?
It's a very desperate situation because, you know, a lot of people, especially those who are fortunate enough, managed to flee Bukavu maybe in the past a couple of days as news about the advance of the M23. So some fled even towards the border with Burundi. Some were saying possibly they might just head even farther, even to Rwanda. So then you have lots of people who are now stuck in Bukavu. Shops have been closed. A lot of people have not been in a position to stock up food. So we're seeing possible food shortages. And now with the reports that the World Food Programme warehouse was looted, you could see just how desperate the situation is. A lot of people saying they have no choice.
And that was Richard Kagoi giving us his views there on the humanitarian situation. One resident who asked us not to share her name because of concerns for her safety told us more about what is happening where she is.
The things are not easy. People are afraid. We feel that we are abandoned by the authorities, either the military, the political, all the authorities, if they are no longer there. We are afraid because of the crackling of the bullets. Many people are going to loot, especially the youth. They are in the streets, destroying the shops, even some storage places. But those who have the means, they stay home. Yeah, like me, and the streets are empty, except those who go in the street for looting.
And you've shared some videos of people looting with us. It looks like it's a very chaotic scene. These young people, you said, they are looting stores and other warehouses.
The fact of looting is not a good behavior. Many people are extremely poor. For them, it's hard to even have 1 kilogram of salt. I'm not justifying the fact that they are looting because I discourage it, but I think also in the opposition, it's maybe because we are abandoned by the local authorities, that's why they are looting. Don't know who is shooting and why, but the people who are in the streets, they continue to destroy the shops.
You must be hugely worried, you and your family. What are you doing to keep safe? How are you trying to keep safe?
We choose some places where we are far from the windows to avoid going outside. We would wish to leave Bukavu and to go far from the places where we are, but we don't know where to go because even if we go there, we need to carry some food, to have some money with us. And with this, as we are limited, we decided to stay with my family.
Do you have enough food, water?
I only have something that can be sufficient for 3 days. In case we don't have possibility to get food, we can make some porridge.
What are you most afraid about?
In Bukavu, some people are into the army groups, the different army groups. Like now, we heard that some DRC soldiers left, but the fighting, we don't know who is leading it. Now we can hear the shooting outside. I'm afraid of those people who may continue to loot, who can enter into these different houses, and maybe who can decide to bomb some of the cities. It is difficult for me as a woman to go outside, because if I go outside, either I can be raped by someone who is in this position of looting or who maybe belong to any army group. But also I am afraid of any bullets that can take me.
And that was one resident in Bukavu. She asked us not to share her name because of concerns for her safety. This is Krupa Party with NewsHour live from London's new broadcasting house. In Paris this week, the biggest names in the world of artificial intelligence, together with politicians and other business leaders, gathered for an AI action summit. Now, this is a follow-up to the AI safety summit in Bletchley Park in England back in 2023. And one of the key talking points at that summit has been the way in which AI could radically alter the world of work, its threats and its possible promises. That is something I've been talking about with the illustrator Holly Exley and Carsten Jung, a former economist at the Bank of England who is now at the Institute for Public Policy Research, a think tank in London. I began by asking Carsten what his key takeaways are from the AI summit in Paris this week, which he attended.
My key takeaways would be that people are taking AI seriously. You know, it was a very busy summit with lots of side events, people from all over the world. People have clearly woken up to the potential of this technology. I would say, you know, there was lots happening, but the most energy was in accelerating AI deployment and, you know, in different ways. The Americans are all guns blazing on big tech, whereas sort of the French organizers said, we need our own European AI. But it was all about how can we do AI faster and sort of slightly in our own way. But there was very little discussion around how do we actually manage this transition if we get all this AI, if it does arrive in the labor market, if it does, you know, pop up in our social lives. Already in the UK, 1 million people use AI as a companion. And we're not currently having the discussion if we actually want that kind of AI. And of course, in the labor market, it will turn up as well very soon, or has already. And not so much discussion on what to do about it.
Yeah, interesting that focus has been on doing AI faster. With that in mind, what jobs, what roles do you think are most at risk and why?
I think the jobs that will first feel this are sort of back office jobs that can be summarized as that, or white collar jobs. And in particular, it's jobs such as personal assistants, secretaries, marketing associates, customer service professionals, people that work with data entry or data processing. Those are all sort of traditional so-called back office jobs. And actually in the UK, a lot of people are in these jobs. If you just add together the ones I mentioned, you almost get to 1 million people in the UK. And those are jobs you could do remotely, are perhaps those that are at risk first. It's also quite interesting that those type of jobs are more likely to be held by women, 40% more likely. So it's kind of the opposite of the last technological wave that we saw in manufacturing and automation there, that was disproportionately affecting men. Now, disproportionately, it could be affecting women. I think policy and politicians should be on the front foot about this, unlike last time where we didn't do enough to manage the impacts of this.
Well, this is a good point to bring Holly into our conversation. Holly, tell us about your skill set and how you believe AI is impacting your work.
My work is in freelance illustration here in the UK, and I've been doing this full-time for about 12 years now. So I mostly work in the publishing industry. I make images for books and board games, and I work with magazines and marketing projects and with independent businesses as well. So my main concern when it comes to AI is definitely job loss and my career becoming obsolete in time. And my particular concern is with AI generative art. These are programs where a user can input a few prompts describing the kinds of images they want for a particular project or something, and then artificial intelligence, after using a lot of human art that exists on the internet, for example, to train on, they can then create an output which would be a piece of art for the user. As you can see, this could completely omit the need for a human artist or illustrator.
Here's a question though. Do you believe AI art is as good as human art? What does it do better? What does it do worse?
I think this is something that could change quite rapidly, but at the moment, the AI art that I've seen, I don't think compares with human-made art. I definitely think it's something that's hard to put into words. It's more like an instinctual thing. I find the images kind of cheesy, and there's also this real lack of attention to detail at the moment when it comes to things like anatomy or details in backgrounds, like light and texture, and even issues with things like gravity. Just think the small details within an image that don't really make sense because they haven't been made by a human.
Carsten, there's lots of talk about the potential of AI, but what can be done to protect certain industries?
I think maybe the conversation shouldn't be, should we protect entire industries and not allow AI there? But I think a way to think about this is that almost no job is fully automatable or fully, you know, every single task can be done by AI. I don't know, if you take teachers, in theory, I guess, you can think about how an entire teacher could be automated by AI. But a lot of the face-to-face work can't be done. And there is a question of, like, how can we, and this by we, I mean people holding jobs, unions, employers, and government, how can we proactively think about what tasks could be affected and how can we help people transition to do more of the things that are the face-to-face tasks? How can people do more of the things that we don't want AI to do? And I think in jobs like illustration, one thing that humans might be very good at is sitting down with the clients, really understanding what the needs are and having the sort of last mile service that involves really deeply understanding what customers want. That will be quite difficult to automate, and sort of slightly helping people pivot towards doing more of that and perhaps using AI in early drafts or in early development of certain products. I think that that's where the initial action will be, is really helping people double down on the things where AI isn't good and protecting those areas perhaps. And again, it's like unions, policymakers and job holders.
Well, Holly, what are you doing specifically to either cope or combat the change from AI?
I think the way that I will be pivoting in the future, if it does become normal for AI to be used in my particular field, which would be publishing, I plan to contextualise my art a lot more and have a focus on the process, the human being behind the artwork, focus on my work, which is in watercolour. So it's quite a tactile medium. It makes you think of human hands creating brush strokes. So I'll be focusing more on storytelling and perhaps like a more bespoke experience. Perhaps I might move more into selling original artwork and working more with individuals on commissions and that kind of thing.
That was the illustrator Holly Exley, and you also heard from Carsten Jung, an economist with the Institute for Public Policy Research, which is a think tank in London. And they end this hour of NewsHour. Thank you for spending some of your day with us, and do stay with the BBC World Service.